Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The fastest-growing segment of New Hampshire's ski industry does not involve a chairlift. It's backcountry skiing, where people climb up the mountain and then ski or snowboard down. But more people enjoying backcountry winter adventure also means more people heading into avalanche territory. And that's where our guest today comes in. We're talking with Frank Karras, head of the Mount Washington Avalanche Center, which works on avalanche forecasts, education, and rescue. Let's hear your questions or personal experiences with this. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. And Frank Karras, welcome to The Exchange. Nice to meet you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So what are you seeing, Frank, in terms of this increased interest in backcountry adventure? What are people setting out to do these days?
Well, people are taking their skiing off the resorts and into the backcountry. And that backcountry in our area can be many of the glades that have been recently cut or opened, or just open areas in the forest where people have skied and through time, and they're going into steeper terrain and wanting to pursue skiing that in soft snow and fresh snow, similar to what you might see in a western mountain range. Sometimes that pursuit takes them into avalanche terrain as well. We have a little bit of a, from a skier's perspective, a tree density problem here in New England. So to find open slopes that are steep enough for skiing, that often takes you into prime avalanche terrain.
Oh, I see. That's what makes it attractive. So how is it different today, Frank? Because it's been a long tradition, a long tradition here in New Hampshire for people to hike up, to Tuckerman's Ravine and either watch everybody ski down or ski down themselves. So what's sort of new about this? Is it that people are going many more places, or that it's just many more people?
I think it's a combination of both of those things. As you mentioned, there is a long history in New Hampshire, since the 30s when the Civilian Conservation Corps and others started cutting these ski trails. You know, that was kind of the start of downhill skiing. People didn't used to have lifts, right? So people were backcountry skiing from the get-go here. And since that time, certain areas have attracted more people to ski in the steep terrain, particularly Tuckerman Ravine, because of the accessibility. And it's just a short hike out of Pinkham Notch, really 2.5 miles, 3 miles. That area has attracted skiers in numbers. You know, we had early ski races there, the Inferno. We had a party-like atmosphere there developing and really taking off in the 60s and 70s, where people would camp for the weekend and it resembled a big party. People might camp for a week and they'd enjoy spring snow. So, you know, the temperature is much milder. The day is longer. You can get a sunburn, you know, while you're sitting in lunch rocks.
Flannel skiing is exactly what we like to call it in our house. So what has this meant for you, Frank, this increased interest in backcountry skiing and snowboarding? What does that mean for you guys at the Mount Washington Avalanche Center?
Well, what we're seeing is people are taking skiing from spring months and they're doing it in winter months. So they're seeking fresh snow and fresh turns in January, February, March, which is prime avalanche season.
And even earlier. So that used to not be the case. It used to be just go up to Tuckerman's or Huntington in the spring.
Yeah, we'd see, you know, a party or two on a Saturday or Sunday in January 10 years ago, maybe a few more that were poking into that steep avalanche terrain. And these days, not uncommon to see dozens of people on a Saturday in Tux on a moderate risk kind of danger day, trying to, you know, link together turns and prime avalanche terrain. So Gulf of Slides, they're spreading out through the range as well. Anywhere there's those open slopes, which again are generally avalanche paths, people are you know, seeking some solitude and trying to get away from the crowds, maybe looking for slightly lower risk terrain. And, you know, they're finding it, and they've used our avalanche forecast, our users generally, and have extrapolated from what we used to forecast, which was just Tuckerman and Huntington Ravine. They would take that forecast and apply it to some degree of effectiveness in other areas of the range.
Yeah, you guys have recently changed the way you do forecasts, yes. And I definitely want to ask you this. But I'm really interested in what you're saying. You used to see, you know, one party maybe coming up on a weekend in January. Now you routinely see people in midwinter up in avalanche territory all the time. You hinted at it, Frank, but I'd like to hear just a little bit more that people are seeking solitude. What else are they seeking up there?
Well, I think, you know, it's a great challenge to evaluate risks. And, you know, people are looking for an experience more than just sliding down a groom slope. You know, it's not just about the turns, or it's not just about the snow quality. It's about, you know, working as a small team and figuring out what the hazards are and mitigating the hazards, and then just really savoring that day. It typically, you know, might just get one run on a day. And when you're backcountry skiing, that's because you skinned up, right? You either carried your skis on your feet or your backpack for, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 vertical feet. So, you know, those first turns, your legs are already tired and you've got a long way to the car with a backpack. And it's just another day, another way to experience the mountains besides, you know, typically the more typical mountaineering way of just climbing the mountain and hiking down. Now you're climbing the same mountain, but sliding down, right?
Has it meant more avalanches, more people in the backcountry in winter skiing and snowboarding? Because I think most avalanches are triggered by human activity.
That's right. 90% of people who are caught, carried, or buried in an avalanche trigger that avalanche themselves. So we are seeing more human-triggered activity, human-triggered avalanches, that is. And that's mostly due to that people moving into the winter months when you have a much more dynamic snowpack. It's much more changeable. There's more and larger avalanche potential.
Can ice climbers or snowshoers or just plain old winter hikers, can they also trigger avalanches, Frank?
They can indeed. And most of our fatalities due to avalanches reflect that. In the past, most of the people who are being killed by avalanches were in Huntington Ravine or climbing in the range. Of the 15 avalanche deaths, I believe 9, possibly 10, I'd have to look at the charts, but were climbers.
Skiers or snowboarders.
That statistic is changing, though, and I think it's changing in recent times. There are more and more close calls. And because we have such a small sample set, you know, we're really just one big incident away from rebalancing that or changing that number. And again, that's just the presidential range.
How common are avalanches in New Hampshire's White Mountains?
That's a tricky one to pin down. We live in what's called a direct action avalanche regime. So basically, avalanches occur during the storm or during the wind loading event. It's not like Colorado, where a dormant weak layer in the snow will just wake up on a sunny day, you know, 3 weeks or 5 weeks or 6 weeks after it formed. Many areas in the West are going through that now. Our avalanche cycles happen sometimes repeatedly during the storm when there's no one there to see them.
So you don't really know.
Yeah, we see signs of it. We see, you know, the debris. Sometimes we don't see that. It's so wind eroded. But, you know, somewhere in the order of probably 15 avalanche cycles, natural cycles per winter.
So we can't really say, but we can surmise just by looking at the evidence. But they happen. I was talking to an experienced mountain man last night, someone who's been out in the backcountry for a long time, mostly out west. And he said, New Hampshire doesn't have avalanches, does it? And I said, yeah, we do. So, I mean, do people think that avalanches are something that happens in, you know, in France or in Colorado, but not in New Hampshire? Is that the perception?
I think that's part of it. I think when you look around at all the trees in the forest, and, you know, you just wouldn't expect an avalanche to occur.
Because trees would block that big slide.
Yeah. If it's dense forest,
I see.
You don't get that typically. You know, we've had historical avalanches with, you know, 40 acres of trees taken out, like in the winter of 69 on the north side of Mount Madison. And we've had huge avalanches that take out, you know, large sections of just hiking trails. In fact, we had an avalanche, a natural avalanche last winter, I think in late March, hit the upper part of the Winter Lion's Head route, which is typically pretty safe from, it threads the needle through avalanche paths. So, you know, they do happen, and skiers cover more ground when they're skiing and are seeking softer snow. So during the course of that turn, they may be more likely to trigger an avalanche, but an ice climber's feet penetrate the snowpack deeper. So, you know, they certainly trigger their share of avalanches.
Oh, that's interesting. So where do these most often occur, Frank? Everybody's heard of Tuckerman Ravine. Some people have heard of Huntington Ravine. But you just mentioned Mount Madison. I think that's just a regular old mountain, right? Yeah, I mean, I know. I've hiked it myself. But, you know, that doesn't seem like avalanche territory.
Yeah, it doesn't. And, you know, they don't just happen in the Whites. They happen on Katahdin, and they happen in Smuggler's Notch in Vermont. And I heard through the grapevine that a ski patroller was just carried by an avalanche at a Vermont ski area a couple weeks ago.
Whoa, like a regular ski area.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, regular ski area. So first thing in the morning. And that's not something that, you know, is widely known, but these inbounds avalanches happen. And as you know, we had some inbound fatalities out west this year. So avalanches happen all over New England, and typically, you know, 30 to 50 degree slopes is where you're going to see them most, and typically at higher elevations that accumulate more snow.
And 30 again, to 50 degrees, sorry to interrupt, that means, again, that means that the pitch of the mountain, it doesn't,
angle.
You're not talking about temperature.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, pitch of the mountain, slope angle.
Because something you said earlier caught my interest. You said that winter is prime time for avalanches. Before I started getting ready for the show, I thought spring would be more prime time for avalanches because you have more widely fluctuating temperatures. So explain that to us, Frank.
Sure. That's a little tricky. You know, I think statistics might show that there are more avalanches in spring. That's because there's more human contact, right?
Sure.
There's more people
okay.
there. But
yeah.
I think in general for us, you know, frequency is just part of the picture. You know, complexity and size is a part of it. So these spring avalanches might be kind of smallish. You know, there's plenty. Just look in YouTube and you can see avalanche in Tuckerman Ravine. And they're generally harmless. People may be getting carried or not, but it's a thin snowpack that's releasing, or you know, the first day of warming, one of the anomalies we get in Tuckerman Ravine is a waterfall that spills out into the snowpack and can release pretty sizable slides, but they're wet slabs, and as such, they tend to move pretty slow. So the more dangerous avalanche is the midwinter dry slab avalanche. So it's faster moving,
and bigger,
often contains more snow. Yeah, harder to escape. So those are the ones that do more damage.
Let me remind our listeners that they can join us, Frank. Our number here in the Exchange. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, comments, personal experiences with avalanches in New Hampshire's backcountry, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email with your thoughts, comments. It's exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter. Again, you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. And by the way, for more information on this topic and links, you can go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange. We're sitting down this hour with Frank Karas, lead snow ranger and director of the Mount Washington Avalanche Center. And one more time, our email is exchange@nhpr.org. What's your own experience with avalanches, Frank? I'm guessing, given your line of work, you've been caught once or twice.
Yep. Yeah, I've had some close calls and have been caught and carried twice by avalanches. You
know, what's that like, being carried?
It's horrifying. Yeah, it's I equate it to folks that have been, you know, to the beach and they tangle with a wave that's a little bigger than they expected, and you may all of a sudden go from having a good time at the beach swimming to being, you know, washed around in a Maytag and submerged in the water and not really knowing what's coming next. And it's that lack of control and a very deep visceral feeling that you no longer have any control over the destiny of your life
wow.
in the next few moments.
And you have skis on your feet.
And you have skis on your feet, which you're probably madly trying to kick off of your feet. Hopefully you have an airbag pack and beacon probe and shovel in your pack and you're traveling with a group. But in that moment, really feels like, you know, you're at the mercy of a force much larger than you. And in fact, that is exactly what you're at the mercy of.
Wow. Were you buried?
I was not buried in either case. I fought a little bit, and the avalanches were not that big. They were capable, just barely, maybe not even capable of burying me, but they were large enough that, as I said, as I struggled, I broke my ski to get it off my foot. And then the other one was more recently in Huntington Ravine, and just sort of the luck of the terrain pattern below me. I was kind of spit out of the side of the flowing debris, came to rest before the debris flowed over into what we call a terrain trap, which is a lower angle area where the snow would accumulate more deeply and to bury you. And that's what's one of two factors that makes our avalanches kind of dangerous here is they may be small, but there's lots of things to get flushed over, you know, cliffs or into, like boulders and trees, or a terrain trap where the angle changes to a much flatter surface where the snow accumulates quickly and deeply.
So there's more things you can bash into.
Yep.
Trees, boulders. We've got lots of granite boulders.
Yep, plenty of those.
Here in the Granite State. Is that different from out west?
You know, it's been said that it is different. Having spent a fair amount of time out west, there's also plenty of things to hit there.
Sure.
I think... again, partly our statistical set is fairly small, so we have a higher frequency of trauma here. And that's partially due to the fact that many of the people previously killed here were ice climbers. So if you're skiing in Tuckerman Ravine and avalanched in the lip later in the season, which is one of the bigger slopes, you're not likely to hit anything. But as it turns out, not that many people have been skiing the lip in midwinter over time, but many more people have been using Huntington Ravine as a training ground for ice climbing. So you can just trigger a small pocket, as the solo climbers have done in Pinnacle Gully, and you get swept off of a cliff that's, you know, 150 feet tall.
Wow.
So, yeah, so size and the statistical set, it's really kind of hard to extract that. I think the learning is that, you know, a beacon probe and shovel are something you should always carry, but you never rely on that to keep you safe. It's just one of many things in your arsenal.
A little bit later, I'll ask you what people should do as they're heading out. But what did you learn yourself, given this experience that you just described, Frank?
What I learned more than anything, and I continue to talk about it to people that will listen, is that avalanches don't know you're an expert at all, and everyone is capable of succumbing to these heuristical traps of thinking, either you know, the excitement of the snow kind of overwhelming your better judgment, or you know, thinking that you're very familiar with the terrain, so you know that some bit of terrain is probably not going to avalanche. Some stuff going on in your group, either time pressure to get down. There's a lot of things that can make us make bad decisions.
All right. That is a perfect segue to what we're going to talk about next. And we'll start taking your emails at exchange@nhpr.org or your phone calls. We're talking about avalanches today on The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. We welcome your questions, comments, and, of course, personal experiences at 1-800-892-6477. More in a moment.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, growing interest in backcountry skiing and snowboarding and ice climbing and snowshoeing has meant more people venturing into avalanche territory in midwinter. And as we're hearing from our guest, that's unusual. We're talking with the director of the Mount Washington Avalanche Center about these trends and how to assess risk. We'd love to hear from you, too, especially if you're a fan of backcountry skiing, boarding, climbing. What experiences do you have with avalanches? Or just more generally, what questions do you have? Send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Our guest for the hour is Frank Karras, lead snow ranger and director of the Mount Washington Avalanche Center. And Frank, something you said just before the break, you talked about the way people make these decisions. And after there's some tragedy, you know, everybody else kind of Monday morning quarterbacks it and says, what was he thinking? How could he be so stupid? You said something, heuristical trap of thinking. What are sort of the thinking traps that people get into that causes them sometimes to get swept up in avalanches?
Well, that's a great question, and it's been studied quite a bit, even especially outside the field of avalanches in anywhere, any endeavor that involves risk, such as being a pilot or a commercial pilot or driving a UPS truck. There's things that are that affect our thinking that make rational people make decisions that don't appear to be at all rational.
After the fact.
And to know some of those ways of thinking and those mistakes that can go on in a group or by yourself can make your team much stronger in the field and make good decisions, right? The goal at the end of the day of skiing is to go home at the end of it. And to if that means turning around before you complete your objective, that's fine, right? What we're looking for is a safe ski day.
So give us some examples of heuristic or heuristical thinking when it was at play and when it was not.
Yep. So, you know, I think a big one is I'll try to go down through the list. There's an acronym for it called FACETS, and that starts with familiarity. So familiarity with the terrain, where you think, I've been coming to Tuckerman Ravine every April, first weekend of April for 10 years, and there's never been an avalanche, right?
So why would there be one now?
Why would there be one now, yeah. And I know Tuckerman Ravine like the back of my hand. So another one would be acceptance. So, and that's partly about this idea that a slope must be fine because other people have skied it already. It's not going to avalanche because I just watched six people go down it.
Okay, I would think that too.
Yeah, and that's definitely...
I would say, okay, she made it down. I could make it down too.
Yeah, definitely not the case because they're trigger points that that vary. That's not to say that it's completely unsafe, but that's just one data point in an important constellation of other things to consider. There are many other, heuristical traps that lead people down the E. I'm going to go out of order here because as they come to mind, E is the expert halo. So if you're traveling in a group, and this is something we see quite a lot. So if you're traveling in a group and there's one person who's perceived to be a better skier who knows more or presents himself as knowing more, I'm saying him, to bias that, that's probably usually a male. But so people put their stock in that person as the one who's going to make the right decision.
The expert halo.
Yeah. So you don't want to put that expert halo on somebody in your group. You should have a group discussion. Somebody with the smallest voice, the most timid person might have a really good point that needs to be made to the group. Like, even if it's just an intuitive feeling like this is a bad idea.
You know, what's interesting is all the advice is do not venture into the backcountry alone, no matter what you're doing, no matter what time of year. So that's understandable. And I'm going to ask you in a couple minutes about a young man who was very experienced but did go alone and tragically died. But then you read about these group dynamics and, you know, one or two people saying, I'm not sure. But then other people have this expert halo and they say, no, 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 no. Or, as we see in New Hampshire, people drive up from Connecticut or Rhode Island or Massachusetts for the day, and this is their long weekend, and this is the plan, and they don't want to drive back to Boston
right,
or Providence for nothing.
Right.
So there's that push. So there's, you know, I understand the risk of going solo, but then there's also sometimes unhelpful group dynamics
at
work.
Yeah, and
I'm sure you've seen
that. Got the other, that A wrong. The acceptance is actually being accepted by your group. So if everyone's doing it, it's kind of the age-old like thing that leaves teenagers to drink or do drugs, right? They want to be accepted by their group. So, well, if they're going to do it and they don't feel bad about it, I don't want to say no and turn around. So I want to be accepted by my group. And that's one of the things that really drives our sort of party atmosphere where people are charging up with, you know, there's 500 people in Tucker and Ravine in the spring, and one person skis a big steep slope and gets applauded. Well, there's a bunch of other people that want to experience that too.
I want to go to our listeners, and then I have a bunch more questions for you, Frank. Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Ron from Campton sent us a story. He says, about 5 years ago, I was ice climbing in Smuggler's Notch in Vermont, and my climbing partner triggered a small, narrow avalanche that buried me. Wow, Ron. After it passed, Ron says, I was able to stand up and walk away. Both of us have had extensive avalanche training, but we never thought you could have avalanches in Vermont. We neglected to carry any kind of avalanche terrain gear. We were very lucky, Ron says. Wow, Ron, thank you for sharing that story. I know you work in New Hampshire, but are Vermont and Maine much different in terms of avalanches than New Hampshire? They don't seem very avalanche prone, just
no,
given the different terrain there.
They're actually... they're different in some ways, but they certainly have avalanches. There's been a fatality in Smuggler's Notch, a guy who was filming for a ski movie years ago in one of the couloirs there. We had some guys from the military who shared an amazing story about their team assessing a slope that slid and carried a number of them. One was hurt really badly.
Tell people what a couloir is. So.
Oh, sorry. A gully, or basically like
a
drainage.
Okay.
It's like a small version of a ravine.
Okay.
So basically something that a little slope, narrow, typically narrow, that's been cleared out by rock or icefall or landslides are another part of the avalanche terrain picture.
Ron mentioned that he didn't expect to get caught into an avalanche in Vermont, even though he was experienced. What should people bring with them when they venture into avalanche territory, even if they don't expect an avalanche?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing is, and the most important thing, particularly for climbers, is that awareness that avalanches can and do occur. And taking an avalanche class is a great start. Anybody that has any intention of climbing in the high mountains, alpine climbing, or any ice climbing in New England should consider taking a 3-day avalanche class to know what to look for. Beyond that, you know, there's some fundamental safety gear that we recommend everybody carry that are useful for lots of things, but a shovel would be the one thing to dig your partner out, right? You can also dig a shelter with that if worse came to worse and you needed to overnight a snow shelter. And then you carry a probe, and most importantly for the avalanche scenario, you wear an avalanche beacon. So this is a little device that is used to locate your buddy with another little device strapped to himself. And it's essentially a way to hone in on their exact location. So these other devices that people carry, satellite communication devices, cell phones, none of those GPS enabled, like those EPIRBs, those really don't work on a fine enough scale to find someone in an avalanche. So,
well, plus if you're stuck in an avalanche, you're probably not going to have use of your hands.
Correct. Yeah.
So what's the difference between a probe and a beacon?
So the probe is basically a tent pole with a point on it that's about 8 feet long. And once you find someone's rough location within a meter or two of the snow, you use the probe to find out exactly where they are. You leave that probe in place, and then you dig to them. So that essentially the job of moving snow with one of these shovels that you can carry is a huge job. An average depth of burial is, you know, someone buried 3 meters deep, you might move a ton and a half of snow.
That is
you get to them.
A terrifying picture.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
And this raises a question that may be a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
No such thing.
Do people who venture a lot into avalanche territory wear equipment or carry equipment that functions like an airbag? Like if you get hit, it blows up like an airbag so that it creates at least a space of air around you so you can breathe while people are trying to find you?
Well, people are wearing those. Certainly a useful thing. It's an airbag pack.
Okay.
And it's deployed by the skier when they initially get avalanche. They'd pull basically a rip cord
like
on their shoulder strap. Yep, like a parachute. And it works through a process of inverse segregation. So if you shake a bowl of nuts, the walnuts rise to the top, right? And the filberts or hazelnuts go to the bottom. So the idea is that if you're traveling on the avalanche debris, you now take up a lot more volume than you would if you didn't have the airbag pack, so you float to the surface. The trick is, the problem is that those airbag packs aren't really going to help you if you get slammed into a tree or a boulder, or if you're pushed into one of those flat areas that I mentioned earlier, terrain trap. The snow can just continue to pile on top of you once you stop. So they're not a magic bullet. They are effective. And I think the last, if I can recall the data, if 11, they could have saved 11% of people who are buried by avalanches.
That's helpful, but not super
Not super helpful, right? Because people don't practice with them enough, so they don't pull the ripcord right, or they don't pull the ripcord out before they get in the terrain.
Well,
they don't expose it.
They
think they're okay.
I mean, it's kind of too bad it's not like an airbag, which deploys automatically upon a certain degree of impact.
Yeah.
Okay.
That can be your next career. Maybe
there you go. Our number again for you to join us with your comments and questions about avalanches in New Hampshire. As we're hearing, this is something that does happen and more frequently than you might think. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us your questions or experiences in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Peter from New Ipswich asks, what is the best thing to do if caught in an avalanche? Never mind what you should have with you, which you talked about, you know, a shovel and a beacon and so forth. But what should you do if all of a sudden you find yourself in this situation?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do. First of all, like right before you get into the terrain, you would want to not have your wrists and the wrist leash of a ski pole, right? You want to be able to free your hands to swim freely. The idea with it's a little bit like white water, you know, you want to try and get out of the flow. So you can roll to the side of the flow once you're captured. In rare cases or certain cases, you could dig down to what's called the bed surface beneath the flowing debris to stop yourself. Sort of like a duck dive in the ocean. That's a little difficult because the debris is pretty hard and fast moving and strong, can be forceful, can
debris
be hard.
Rocks and
hard snow
big
chunks.
And,
debris,
okay.
The avalanche, the snowy avalanche debris. So quite powerful. So diving down doesn't always work.
But diving off to the side,
yeah, rolling maybe. That's something that's kind of new as a theory. You know, the swimming motion, I know when I was caught, I wasn't in that turbulent flow. So keeping my feet downhill to protect me against objects coming made sense, and doing like a backstroke to try to keep my head oriented so it's not going first down the slope. That was a strategy, and all those things, are helpful. Some folks I know, recommend you, if you're crossing a suspect slope, you would take your backpack straps off. I don't know if that's really commonly taught. I think probably it's not a great idea. It's hard to ditch your backpack.
Well, and you may have elements in there that'll help you survive.
That you would need, yeah, right. And you would also have some level of protection to your spine if you had the backpack on.
Billy sent us an email to ask, if something goes wrong while in the backwoods, would the New Hampshire Hike Safe Pass cover any costs of rescue? That's a good question, Billy. And for listeners who don't know what a Hike Safe Pass is, you pay a set fee every year. And basically then if you do get involved in an expensive search and rescue, you know, the cost is covered. If you don't have the pass, Fish and Game in the state may ask you if it seems like you were negligent to pay for those costs. So can you answer Billy's question about that?
Well, I would always suggest people support that Hike Safe program for lots of reasons. It's, you know, it's hard to say whether it would be needed for you in that case. In the avalanche world, you know, you have, you know, if you're buried, you need to be extricated within 15 minutes or you're more than likely going to die. So it's really about rescue within your group. Well, avoidance first and then self-rescue within your group.
Oh, that's interesting.
If someone has to come from outside, like you're more than likely not going to survive if you've been buried.
Because we've done many, many shows on White Mountain search and rescue, and we've heard dramatic stories of rescue parties going up and so forth. It sounds like it's a little different with an avalanche rescue because time is so very limited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So asphyxia is what you're racing against, right?
Lack of oxygen.
Yep. So you've got about as long as you can hold your breath and then some. There's a little bit of air contained in the snowpack, but generally that's going to run out as the snow melts around your face and creates an ice mask. So, but most people, you know, many people caught and carried just get an injury. So they might break their leg or something, you know, some sort of injury that does require evacuation. And again, self-reliance, I always preach because that's your fastest, best bet. You know, whether it's a 5x8 tarp and some parachute cord.
Another reason to not leave your backpack behind.
Splint your buddy, yeah, right. Put them in the tarp, bundle them up with their skis like a burrito and start dragging them out, right? Like that's going to be better than waiting, you know, 3 hours for someone to come and get you.
Sure. Well, thank you for the email, Billy. It's a good question. John in Springfield wrote in to say, we lost a great friend years ago to an avalanche on Mount Washington. Tom Burke and another person in a separate party died as the result of separate slides that were caused by the same triggering mechanism. John says Tom had decided to turn around due to changing weather conditions while others continued up. He was still in a slide zone when a slide was triggered by those above him. Ugh. From all accounts, he survived the first slide and a secondary event took his life. Timing and position are everything with avalanches. John writes, I have been in 3 small slides myself, 2 in New Hampshire, 1 in Colorado. Even small ones will unnerve you. Easterners like me are often oblivious to the existence and danger of slides, and they happen here too. And John, I'm so sorry about your friend. And it sounds like almost he was trying to do the right thing. You know, he didn't feel safe, so he started coming down, and then boom, it's a terrible story.
Yeah, that's a tough story, and that's one that you know, is one of the ones that keeps me up at night is thinking about those mass casualty potential avalanches. We had a secondary avalanche triggered on a rescue party last year where a person triggered an avalanche. It carried a number of people in Hillman's Highway.
Where is that, by the way?
That's just outside of Tucker, near Hermit Lake, but very close to Tuckerman Ravine, and that person continued hiking up the slope into what we call the hang fire. So the rest of the slope that hadn't avalanched and triggered another avalanche on the people below. So, you know, some working together in our crowded mountain range and being good citizens is part of this picture as well.
So the more people, the more possibility for avalanches, because as you said earlier, 90% of avalanches are triggered by people walking around on the snow.
Yep.
John, I'm so sorry to hear your story, and thank you for contributing it to our conversation today. We will talk more after a very short break, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, your reaction to the Senate impeachment trial. Send us your thoughts before the show to exchange@nhpr.org and then join us live Wednesday morning at 9. This hour, understanding avalanche risk in New Hampshire's backcountry. We've been talking with Frank Karras, lead snow ranger and director of the Mount Washington Avalanche Center. And we've been hearing from you, your questions, comments, and personal stories about this. 1-800-892-6477 is how you can join our conversation. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also use Facebook or Twitter. And Frank, right back to our listeners. And Nico's calling from Newbury. Hi, Nico. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Yeah. My question is, are crevasses a danger during an avalanche? Like, could you fall into one?
Thank you very much, Nico. And for the non-backcountry public, explain what a crevasse is, please, Frank.
So a crevasse technically occurs in a glacier, you know, moving snow that turns into ice on a glacier. In our case, we have, we call them crevasses. Technically, they're moats. They're basically big cracks in the snow as it creeps downhill. We have some waterfall holes that open up. And her question, she's exactly right. They are very, very dangerous. They're probably the ultimate terrain trap. If you're swept into that and then buried by snow, it's obviously going to be, you know, very hard, if not impossible, to dig someone out in time. So
I think of those happening in, you know, those giant mountains that they have in France
in
and Switzerland. Yeah, the Alps and Switzerland. And But we have them here in New Hampshire?
We do, yeah, in Tuckerman Ravine. We have such a large snowpack that blows in. It's, you know, 40 feet and more feet thick. That does start to creep downhill. We get these moats next to rocks that can be kind of deep. And then the waterfall holes, as I mentioned, and then other cracks adjacent. And we've definitely had at least a couple of fatalities. And I know at least one of those rescue attempts we had to abandon due to the threat of avalanches as it snowed.
Sure, because you're the rescuer.
Right.
You're out there in avalanche territory. You don't know when the next one is going to hit.
And even a small avalanche could fill that hole.
Wow. Nico, thank you very much for calling. And Alan is calling from Meriden. Hi, Alan. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, and it's more of a statement, I suppose, of I rarely hear discussion of the at least helpful tool of even consumer-grade two-way radios. So their ability to transmit over long distance is very marginal. Within a party, if one skier or two skiers in a group first go down a slope, the ability to call back up and indicate what they found within the terrain, or if there is a separation, the ability to shout in some of our mountain terrain, the voices don't travel very far. Could you address that? And again, I think they're a tool that often is overlooked, but of course nothing is a magic bullet, as you said.
Sure.
Thanks so much. I'll listen off the air.
Oh, Alan, it's great to hear from you. Thank you for calling. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. That's a good question. And communication, like many things, is the root of lots of problems. Poor communication, anyway. So radios can be a part of that picture. I know groups can work out hand signals as well, or ski pole signals to indicate, you know, don't ski this line, or ski to the right of my track or to the left of my track. Inter-party communication, that would be a great solution. Communicating with other people outside your party would be kind of a challenge with those, because everyone could have their frequencies set differently. But you do raise a good point that communication in your team is very important.
All right. Thank you very much for that call. And let's take another one. Jeff is in Rye. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air with Frank Karras. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. And hi, Frank. And thanks so much for all your work.
You're welcome.
I'm calling today. I'm a longtime backcountry snowboarder. I started back in the late 80s, early 90s, just hiking up into Tux like everybody else. I think elder in the snowboarding community at this point. I'm the splitboard ambassador for Granite Backcountry Alliance, and also two separate snowboard companies. And I just wanted to, thanks again for all the work and education that you all have been doing, and just sort of looking at it from the point of view over history of watching the snowboarding community. We tend to like to think of ourselves as mavericks, and, you know, we're not going to do what the man tells us to do. We're going to go no matter what. And I can't tell you how many times I've walked up to hiked up or skinned up recently as a splitboarder to Summit Lake and seen the avalanche danger signs, and watching a bunch of, in my dotage now, increasingly younger snowboarders look at the avalanche danger and then either make a good decision and go down, or just say the heck with it and keep going up. Just watching the groundswell, I think, of education and the mind shift, both within the industry. I work for Karakoram Bindings and Weston Snowboards, and just in the industry itself and with Granite Backcountry Alliance, just really increasing awareness and education and people seeming to embrace that more.
So the mind shift is good, Jeff. People are understanding the risks even as they're going out more. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. And maybe, I don't know the numbers, if there's that kind of data and metric tracking out there, but looking at the younger and younger folks, I think they're just coming into it with more eyes wide open. And I think folks like Mount Washington and other organizations that are doing more on social media, and there's more of a presence where they're making the resources more readily available. And it's becoming like a source of pride for folks. Like, yeah, well, I'm not even going to go into the backcountry and take it until I take an ARRI 1 or a backcountry survival course. And
wow, so
all
the information that people have is helping them make better choices. And you guys at the Mount Washington Avalanche Center put out a lot of information on social media. Your forecasts, your descriptions are incredibly detailed. Go ahead, Frank. I'd love your thoughts. And Jeff, thank you very much. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, those are great, great points. And I think since he's in the industry, he knows better than anyone that numbers, our ranks are swelling in a huge way. And there was a paper written recently that was debunked that, you know, there are more avalanche fatalities and that wasn't really the case over time if you compare it to the number of participants. So the reality is
you have to look at percentages then.
Yeah. So avalanche forecasting and avalanche education, not necessarily in that order, are, you know, assumed to be a big part of that equation. So we're happy to try to reach out to people through new venues. There's amazing, you know, people who don't know there are avalanches, as you suggested, Diane, as you know, they're not going to know to look for an avalanche forecast. So if we can bump into those people, or they can see a post on Instagram, you know, with a fracture line or, you know, a dog searching or anything that indicates, that raises their awareness that there are avalanches, then that's going to help.
It's really interesting to hear you and Jeff say that you're using social media and other tools of communication, and people seem to be getting the message, you know, don't do it that day. We've done whole shows on tech in the backcountry, and there's another sort of counter narrative that people want that awesome video to share or that awesome picture to share, and that it pushes them to take risks that they might not have taken. So I just wonder where you fall down on that.
Yeah, I would think that's a, you know, an age-old ego-driven decision-making problem. You know,
yeah.
We used to call it Kodak courage.
That was
back
really?
In the days of print film, right? People doing stupid things for the camera. But, you know, it's part of the sort of consistency, commitment, heuristic. Like, I got to go get that shot, and I'm going to just, you know, abandon all, well, make that poorly valued decision, you know, and end up getting avalanche. So,
Kodak,
you know,
courage. So this is not really a new
thing. No, it's not new. It's just more prevalent, I think. And, you know, these tools make it very convenient to post photos. You know, it's a double-edged sword. We love seeing information. We get information about the snowpack around the range from people's Instagram posts and their hashtags of the Avalanche
Center.
Yeah,
you guys use social media input from people who are out there to improve your own information.
Yep, and we have
an
observation page on our website, which we really encourage people to look, because it's a continuous record that's easier to search. It takes a little bit more effort, but people can provide information about what they saw some other place in the range. And that is super helpful, because there's, you know, a limited number of snow rangers, and we have a limited amount of time, so we can't get everywhere. So people posting short videos or little pictures with a snow pit or just the terrain is super helpful. And, you know, back to that social media, it's just great that, you know, we have friends groups that are supporting us, Friends of Tuckerman Ravine and the White Mountain Avalanche Education Foundation. So they own these websites and these social media platforms and allow us as government employees to post that information and also interact with the public.
And let's just say the Mount Washington Avalanche Center is sort of it's led by the U.S. Forest Service, right, Frank? But it's in partnership with many other organizations.
Yeah, that's correct. So the Forest Service has operated all the avalanche centers outside the state of Colorado through time, and it's a really unique thing that the federal government does, these backcountry avalanche forecasts. And they also run the military artillery program.
Okay, so and lots of links on our website as well, including obviously to the Mount Washington Avalanche Center, where you can see the forecast and look at the detailed descriptions that Frank and his team post there. Thank you so much for that call, Jeff. Here's an email from Douglas in Pike. I've been skiing in Tuck and ice climbing in Huntington since the 1960s. Wow. And have always been grateful for the great info from the Mount Washington Avalanche Center. Douglas says, due to that good information and a certain degree of cautiousness and also luck, I have never been in an avalanche. I recall hiking up to Huntington and looking up and thinking, no way, and bailing out, which people sometimes need to do. Douglas says, I was in Tuck last spring and witnessed my first ever helicopter rescue. It was a coolish day, but people were pushing it up the chute and somebody had a major fall. Douglas says, people are definitely pushing the limits. Notably, many more people are skiing in winter when it used to just be a spring thing. But we always need to be prepared, he says, especially mentally. Douglas concludes by saying, it is so beautiful up there, so special, just amazing, but we all need to constantly use our heads. Douglas, thank you so much for that. Doug in Windsor, Vermont says, are there good resources to learn more about avalanches online? Videos, articles, websites? If I just watch all of Andrew Drummond's Ski the Whites videos, am I good to go? And by the way, we had Andrew on our show about 2 winters ago to talk about backcountry skiing. Doug, thank you very much for asking about resources and education. And before I ask you that, Frank, another email has a similar question. Carlin Rumney says, I have a very eager 12-year-old backcountry skier and mountaineer. We have up to now avoided avalanche terrain in our winter trips, but I am aware that soon we will be heading into those areas. What courses and education opportunities, Frank, recommend for teens and or other novice white mountain adventurers? So both Carl and Doug wanting to know where they can learn more.
Yep. So we've got a list of avalanche education providers that are in the Valley and Mount Washington Valley. And I think also we have some listed in Vermont where people could go and sign up for those 3-day Avalanche Level 1 classes, which are a great place to start. You can check our events calendar on MountWashingtonAvalancheCenter.org for upcoming talks, though most of those have passed right now. But we're trying to get out in the community increasingly and give an hour and a half or so avalanche awareness talk, which is one place to start. You can talk to, if you visit us, if you come to Tuckerman Ravine, you can talk to one of our awesome ski patrollers. A Mount Washington Volunteer Ski Patrol has been helping us do what we do for decades now. And many of those folks have skied or climbed all over the mountains and can help you come up with a strategy to get the goods, have a good ski run, and stay safe. I think to one of the earlier points, there are great online resources. Definitely be careful. Many of those ski videos that are just look so awesome and dramatic, what you're not seeing is the safety things that are going on in the backcountry. You know, those guys triggering these avalanches and riding them out. For every one of those, you know, there's one out there where someone gets caught, carried, or injured, or buried. And what you also don't see in those videos is there's a team of guides or avalanche professionals and rescuers that are tucked just behind the ridge, ready to swoop in and save this person. It's not just a solo skier doing this rad thing.
How many snow rangers are there on your team?
There are four snow rangers, and we have about 20 people on our ski patrol. So those the snow rangers are our forecast team, and they, you know, we lead rescues in the Cutler River drainage for 6 months of the year. We take that over from the state, and the ski patrol comes in March to help us with the large numbers
when
of
the crowds
that
really
start to
form.
Yeah. And there are nurses and EMTs.
Oh,
and,
wow. Yeah, four doesn't sound like very many people.
No, it's we'd like to have more people. I'd love to have at least another person to help with our avalanche education and outreach.
Because you're doing education and outreach and forecasting, mm-hmm. and you're going out there and, you know, trying to grab people when they get in trouble. Any women among your snow rangers?
Not on the snow ranger team this year. We had an emergency hire. We've had a couple of emergency hires in the past who were on the snow ranger team. And we have, I think, 5 of our ski patrollers are women who are awesome and bring a great depth of experience and perspective to the ski patrol and to the team.
So I was looking a lot at your forecasts yesterday, Frank, and the avalanche danger today is considerable. That's the term that you use. And there's two more degrees of danger after that, right? Mm-hmm. What are those? After
high and extreme.
So here's the thing. If the avalanche danger is extreme or even high, why doesn't the Forest Service just shut those areas down?
Well, we feel that, recreation is by choice and it's public land. And we just do our best to inform people as much as we possibly can to reach those folks. There's pinch points where, there's signage and, there's plenty of places out there where it's not so obvious that aren't forecast and do not have a sign on it. So it's really up to people to be aware of the fact that snow is a dynamic thing. And, people can get buried. There are two fatalities from roof avalanches in the country last year. So anywhere there's snow on a steep slope, you should be thinking avalanches. And if it's really, really snowing hard or blowing hard, you should think twice and look for some information before you head into the backcountry.
If you could just wave a magic wand, Frank, what's one thing you would change about this whole line of work that you do?
Oh, I would love to have a much greater awareness about in the public about the risk of avalanches and the fun that can be had in avalanche terrain as well, safely.
Okay. It's been really good to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Laura. It's good.
That's Frank Karas. Again, he's the lead snow ranger and director of the Mount Washington Avalanche Center. Check out our website for a lot more information and links. Again, that's nhpr.org/exchange. And you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.